Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And so now we're at the discussion section, which is actually quite short. And we also want to try to take some questions and discussion from the audience. But one of the things I realized was that I didn't really address, and we haven't really specifically addressed some of the core things that we're asking at this conference, which is the limit of copyright. And particularly in this session, I sort of started talking about Ronald Coase and what the firm was, but I didn't really talk about what happens afterwards. I think Yohai touched on it. But the kind of thing that I'm also thinking, I've been doing a lot of press interviews. And so we're a bunch of believers talking to each other. But the press always asks the question, well, what about us? What happens to the firm? What happens to us? And I think one of the questions is, and also with the government as well, what happens to the centrally planned, previously very efficient mode, which is the firm or the centralized government that did the central planning, when these systems come out? So the question that I kind of pose is, and to anybody who wants to make a comment here. Yes, we need some more microphones, if you have any. But the question is, what happens to the firms? Is there a hybrid economy that where we coexist with these guys, or do they disappear, or do they mostly disappear, some disappear? And what are these limits, and is there an elegant solution, or is there a war? What happens? And I realize everybody's got a slightly different angle. And then I'd also toss in the Clay Shirky makes a very interesting point that one of the successes of open source is the failure costs very little money. It's that the cost of failure is very low. And I kept bringing this up in the context of economy is that in municipalities and all these other things, by allowing the amateur to participate and to innovate, hacker innovation, artist innovation, this lowers the transaction cost, lowers the cost of failure, because we now have the tools to do this at a very low cost. And I think a lot of the firm was about managing expensive resources efficiently, but when the cost is so low, we can have chaos and still have emergent innovation. So I'm sort of jumping around here, but maybe, I don't know if Yohai wants to start, because I started the Coase's Penguin thing, but maybe you can finish that, and then we can have a short discussion about the themes of the conference.
So I don't think the firm is going to disappear. That's why I pointed out social sharing and exchange as part of an ecosystem with remaining firms. But I think firms are under a lot of pressure, and they need to change anyway. I mean, even within, I mean, you see firms changing in terms of their internal structures, moving away from relatively tight hierarchies throughout most of the first, I'd say, two-thirds of the 20th century, through a fairly short love affair with tight monitoring and incentive schemes, to an increasing effort to create more collaborative workspaces, give employees greater freedom, create teamwork, you see a lot more disaggregation now in contract-based relations with suppliers who are themselves co-producers. And so there's a lot of work within the business literature about inter-firm relationships that is itself already reminiscent of this, where the boundary of the firm where the boundary of tasks within the firm becomes much looser, and employees get a lot more power within the firm to define the production process, exactly in order to elicit the insights that they can bring, and where you get a lot more contracting out to networks of firms that are working together. So this is coming from inside the firm itself. At the same time, firms that are seeing the emergent creativity and innovation out there in the social cloud, as it were, are also trying to do that. And so I think what we're seeing is firms beginning to chew on, and I can't tell you there's a particularly successful model, but I do find myself talking to newspaper companies, or traditional media companies, or certainly technology companies that are trying exactly to do that. So when you have the BBC setting up the, if you've been here and seen a photo, upload your report. If you have the LA Times creating a utility that says, send us your photos, then people vote on them and whether they're good or not. That's already firms beginning to understand being there is something that requires not only a professional being part of, but also just being there and then creating this. Now, this is complicated because once you're actually inviting someone to a role that's inside, you can't just keep treating them as consumers that need to be manipulated. So, you know, when Digg suddenly finds out that it's creating outrage among diggers when it's removing the DVD decryption code, you find this this statement of, you know, if we have to go down, we have to go down. But you've said that we have to put it on. So here it is in a post from me. And if we go down, we go down. And you saw it in Second Life when they were trying to change the pricing structure and you saw tax hikes. So this is a central struggle for companies that are understanding that they need to adapt. There's no clear solution. I think one of the things that needs to go into understanding what are the social dynamics of collaboration is also to teach firms about the affect needs to change. You need, even the internal managerial commitments need to be from managers who are particularly good at optimizing within to people who really get the social dynamic. You get somebody like Craig Newmark playing what role, essentially, personifying a commitment to a public effort. So this is the direction that firms need to go in order to adapt from closed systems to more permeable systems and from what they're learning about inter-firm relationships to the relationship between the firm and the social environment they operate in.
You should probably explain who Craig Newmark is.
Craig Newmark, Craigslist, company that basically is now the major platform for individuals to put on whatever personal ads, sell things, advertise for jobs, etc. It's a company with about 20 employees that has essentially sucked the life out of the newspaper ad industry, but has been enormously effective with a tiny group and led by Craig Newmark, who's a character who spends at least half of his time being a public person and at most half of his time being essentially within the company.
Is it true they're refusing to grow in terms of staff, or they are?
I can't tell you that I know that they're formally refusing. They're not growing. And given the possibilities and given the amount of attention that comes, I suspect that this has to be because that's what they intend to do. I don't know. Have you gotten a chance to talk to him about that particular question?
I think that they've been pretty insistent. I've been looking at them from the investor perspective, but they told their investors that they're not going to be pushed to grow and grow and grow. And also, Craig Newmark actually spends most of his time answering customer support. And that's his main job. You know, that's his favorite job. So it's a very interesting company. But and also it's interesting because it was the bloggers that the newspapers thought were their main enemy. But in fact, it was Craigslist that took all their money, you know. And so you can have all the content you want, but if you have if you lose your revenue, so that's the other, I think, interesting twist, that it turns out that Craig Newmark killed the newspaper, not the bloggers.
Not dead yet.
Yeah, that sounds like the Monty Python movie, like, well, I'm not dead. But they're being brought to the cemetery already.
But what I think is that all of this corporation stuff and all these new peer economy, and I want to relate to your question whether will firms disappear or what's the role of government relating to these new developments. And I think what is important to see is that it won't come on its own, or it's not without dangers for these developments to evolve. And I think it changes the role of firms probably in many instances, and it probably should also change the role of government to a more enabling role. But as we see, especially in the U.S., there is this huge debate on net neutrality already. For example, this shows that many of these freedoms that are necessary to cooperate and necessary to produce and necessary for this commons-based peer production, as you call it, they are precarious in a way. And I think it's the greatest danger I see, and I also experience, is that especially in the political sphere, even more in, than in the business sphere. Because in the business sphere, we have two camps. One, that are making already money with new business models, and of course, they know what they are doing. And on the other hand, we have this camp that is frightened or that has problems dealing with these new business models. But in business, as far but in politics or in government, as far as I see it, there is just ignorance dealing with this issue. And I think the situation may be a little bit better in the U.S. because the internet plays a larger role in politics in general already. But in Europe, I don't know any blog that is important in Germany or in Austria in politics. So there are special blogs like netzpolitik.org, but actually that's special interest. Yeah? That's not the main public that is involved in this. And so I think the biggest problem is ignorance and letting slip away the potentials that could develop because we don't know that there are preconditions that have to be delivered even in the new economy or in the peer economy or in the new cultural economy.
Joey, one of my heroes in the business world is Edwin Deming. And the thing that he said in the 1950s that was so radical was that that the ultimate measure of importance of the firm was really the ability of the employee to find a self-fulfilling role within that company. And his whole message about transformation began very much at the individual level. In 1975, a book was published called Small is Beautiful, and the subtitle of the book was Economics as if Humans Mattered. Now, we all know that Deming's teachings were completely ignored by the people who paid for them, the U.S. automotive industry, and those teachings went to Japan, and Japan taught the world a lesson on what can happen when the firm takes account of people. Now, even to this year, the arrogance of the conventional global firm that basically says profits are more important than people continues to misunderstand what Deming has so elegantly demonstrated these last 50 years. And I believe that the battle that we're playing on now, and I'm excited to see this ferment in the political discussion within the city of Linz, is that God did not give a deed of global monopoly to any one company or to any one country to dominate exactly how everything will be done. And the opportunity to do something better, as Japan showed with manufacturing, I believe that the opportunity to do something better with intellectual property remains as long as countries or at least municipalities reject global intellectual property hegemony. It is frightening to me the extent to which the U.S. is promoting trade policies and trade negotiating positions that make it impossible for anybody to come up with any alternative ways of doing things. It would be as if we were dictating that from now on, the world will only eat wheat, corn, and soybeans grown with genetically modified seeds, fertilized with patented materials, or animals must eat those things. And thankfully, with 5,000 years of agricultural history behind us, farmers are willing to stand up and say, no, what you are prescribing for me is not right for me. I have experience in my region. Intellectual property in its modern construction is barely 100 years old, really, and maybe 200 at the most. And so we have a lot less experience, but we must reject this homogeneity and hegemony, and we must sustain independent action. And the reward will be as great for those who innovate in ways of understanding and applying intellectual property as was the rewards of putting people at the front, not profits. The profits will come if you take care of the people.
Can I make a small point here just to clarify, because sometimes people misunderstand. Homogeneity is very different from standardization and open specification. So TCPIP allowed us to have one internet, which allowed us to have diversity. And HTTP is an open specification that allows us to interoperate, because interoperability allows intercultural communication and allows us to actually fight against the kind of standardization which I would say would be bad.
Right.
And similarly, I think what's really important is that, and this is, I'm pitching my Creative Commons thing here, is that you don't want to be creative with licenses. You don't want 10 TCP/IPs. We already have 500 open source licenses that you have to spend legal, well, but there are 500 that call themselves open source. But you have to hire lawyers and they're not interoperable. And so, because some people say, well, Creative Commons is an American imperialist thing to try to stamp out similar projects across the world. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to get, we have 47 jurisdictions and people in 80 countries, and we're trying to create a consensus process for a single specification. And I think it's actually kind of a fine line, because you'll have other standards bodies, like, I won't name them, but that have corporate interests that actually have attached to the specification a bunch of things that actually push towards this kind of homogeneity. And it's actually kind of a nuanced thing that you have to be kind of aware of, especially if you're setting policy.
But as we're talking about putting people before profits, as we're talking about the role of government, I think it's also important to capture that there's something very interesting happening politically and theoretically in this conversation, which is to say that you're finding kinds of commitments and kinds of attitudes that used to be very starkly separated into left and right, beginning to occupy common spaces and potential coalitions. And so, for example, the question of government, understanding government as a source of support, as a source of solutions, has definitely been a character of much of the left, and its rejection has been a character of at least the liberal right. But when we look at the last 10 years, and when you look at hacker culture, when you look at Creative Commons, when you look at open source licensing, these are all solutions that are contra government. These are all solutions that are anarchistic or libertarian, depending on which orientation you want to go. But a certain skepticism about the potential constructive role of a progressive government agenda, but like the one that you've described, is something that I think is part of the conversation now. At the same time, some of the values that we're talking about, like putting people before profits, like making central the capacity of people to participate and act, these are considerations that are more, as it were, on the left, but you're finding them very much understood now as the necessities of business, driven by business. You see a much more fractured business environment around the question of intellectual property. You just had this report out from the Computer Association in the U.S. about fair use and the fair use industries being worth something like 18% of American GDP or something like that. Beginning of organization of structured lobbying by firms in favor of fair use in the public domain because they understand it as a form of regulation on them. So the politics have become very fluid and counterintuitive, and the potential coalitions are very interesting.
Unless you have some comment, are there any questions or discussion points from the audience? We've got a few minutes. Oh, there's. Can we get a mic?
Hello, my name is Juha Huuskonen. I'm organizer of a festival called Pixelake in Helsinki. I have a question. This is mostly for Jokai about authority and also related to government. The question would be how much this culture that we were seeing, YouTube and so on, how much is that a culture of basically upper class well-being people, a hobby? And then this is related to authority and ownership. I mean, I would say that in these communities, ownership equals authority, but ownership becomes through participation. Like in order to have ownership, you need to participate in the community. And I would take one example, which is Wikimedia Foundation. There was recently, the board was selected, and in order to run for the board, you had to have 200 edits in Wikipedia and so on. So kind of, yeah, like basically who has the voice?
Okay, so those are two excellent but distinct questions. Is the freedom that I'm talking about an elite phenomenon? In many senses, yes. Clearly, internet usage is education-based, is relatively wealth-based. So the but works along several dimensions. First of all, how big the elite is, or how big that range of people who are using, that's why I read the Barb in MD from Koss, was exactly the idea that one could become a really significant voice in the American political system with her background. Now, does that mean everyone? No. Have we moved in the US from, let's say, a few thousand people deciding the agenda to a few million? I think possibly. Moving from a few thousand to a few million in a 300 million people country is not flat. It's still elitist, but it's a very different kind of elitism, and it's much more open. And it ties also to the second question, which is, what are the preconditions of access? Now, one of the core preconditions of access is education. As long as we don't solve the problems of education, we can put all the kiosks we want and yet not solve. Now, where is there a room, I think, for government that could be very productive is precisely in overcoming some of these barriers. So when you have the Brazilian government trying to set up, I know that Ronaldo is here somewhere, Ronaldo Lemos, but the Brazilian government is trying to set up kiosks with training. When they set up Canto Livre and try to capture music that is local music, those are efforts of trying to get public funding and public capabilities to overcome that barrier. But the core question is, what is the precondition to becoming a participant? And what you describe in Wikipedia, I think, yes, it's ownership, but it's ownership metaphorically. Right? It used to be that in order to participate, you had to have ownership or a contract with the owner of the thing. So capital was a precondition to being able to take a position of authority. All you need for a position of authority in Wikipedia is to have come, to have shown up, contributed, done more. And so the barrier is much more about what I'm willing to do to be part of this. And then do you call that elitism? I'm not sure you call that elitism, because it's open to anybody to show up and try to help. And through trying to help and being effective within the group, it's much more about governance and about proving yourself through governance than it is about ownership, though we then reappropriate the word ownership to mean responsibility and relative authority. But the sources of responsibility and authority come from action within the cooperative social enterprise rather than in action within the market through ownership in formal proprietary terms. And that's a big difference, I think.
Thank you. Is there anybody else?
My name is Monica Ermert. I'm a freelance journalist. I have a question that, sorry, goes again to Mr. Wengler. You posed the question, can peer production organizations or firms survive structurization? But you didn't give examples for failure and, let's say, factors why they fail.
Going back to what Joey was saying about the cost of failure, there are millions of failures all over the place. We don't see them. And this notion of constant failure over time. But let's just take the most famous example, which is Wikipedia. Wikipedia starts from Newpedia, which conceives of the model as one in which you allow people to write very large pieces who are more expert, tries to impose a certain structure. The structure fails, but what survives is the platform that allows for open collaboration. You look at something that I'm not sure is a failure, but it's certainly a failure to thrive, is the effort at Wikibooks. You talked about OpenCourseWare. The movement of open textbooks, particularly for elementary and high school, has been much harder. And it's not clear why. There have been a Wikibooks open for a good 3 or 4 years for open textbooks. I'd say the most successful project has been the South African project on free high school science texts. But that involved having a set of graduate students from Cape Town universities sitting, cracking the whip, coming, picking up a module, transferring it to somebody else, persuading somebody else to do it. And when I talked to them about what was their concern, their basic concern was they couldn't chunk the work into such small chunks to allow anybody to just spend 5 minutes. It was the minimum contribution was on the order of 10, 12 days worth of work. And the reason what constrained them was the need to meet a certain set of government requirements about the completeness and the coherence of the text. They couldn't break it down into smaller chunks. And so that's another example that also raises the question of the limits being having to do with the degree to which you can modularize the work and the degree to which modularity is a function of requirements that are institutionally created, like the state, as opposed to general. But I do want to just emphasize, I think the core problem of firms intersecting with social processes is that the value system in which each operates is disparate. And it requires firms to fundamentally change. In this regard, it's similar to the point about textbooks. It also requires governments to change and to give up some control. Right? The fear of giving up control is an enormous constraint on the ability to harness peer production. And for this, just one last example, my Barack Obama has been an enormously successful collaboration and mobilization tool. But at the same time, the single largest group for a while on my Barack Obama was hundreds of thousands of supporters coming and saying, don't vote the way you're voting on the surveillance bill. They didn't chuck it off by Barack Obama. It stayed on there as the largest group, because if you make that contract with a community, you have to keep it. And the willingness to give up control is an enormous barrier.
Thank you. And I think we're at the drop dead time. And so I appreciate everybody for sticking it out and the panelists for joining. And we...